right, this is Movies I Love That No One Talks About. I am your host, Dan Benamor. Today we are talking about the 2018 film Destroyer. The film stars Nicole Kidman, Toby Cabell, Tatiana Maslany, Scoot McNairy, Bradley Whitford, and Sebastian Stan. Karen Kusama directed, and Phil Hay and Matt Manfredi wrote the script. This same team did the film The Invitation. According to the internet, the budget was between $9 and $12.4 million, and the film grossed $5.6 million. It holds a 73% on Rotten Tomatoes. This movie is currently available on Hulu. For anyone who hasn't seen it, if you have Hulu, you can go ahead and watch it. My guests this week are the writers of this film, Phil and Matt. Welcome, guys.
Hey, Dan.
Hello.
So I want to start out with the thing that kind of jumps to mind for me for this movie, and it's something that we've talked about on the show and other projects. This idea of movies that are juice movies that you get to make because you've gotten the juice from something else happening previously in your career, and then you get to go do this thing that is, you know, a little bit wilder, more ambitious, and sort of out there. This feels to me like your guys' juice movie coming off the great reception of The Invitation. Is that true, or is that an incorrect assumption on my part?
In a way, it's hard to say because like The Invitation, the Destroyer took us a very long time to get made. It's kind of the way that it turns out that we work is that it takes like 8 to 10 years from writing our independent scripts for it to kind of happen. And you know, I think it did definitely, there was a desire after The Invitation came out and you know, kind of had really to our delight, obviously, a very enduring kind of reputation, that there was definitely an interest already in what Karin wanted to do, and then what, as a team, we were going to do together. And we had been thinking about and working on the script for Destroyer for a very long time, and it became pretty clear once we started talking to Karin that was the movie we wanted to push up the hill. And every single movie that anybody does, but certainly everyone that we've done has been a real odyssey. None of them are easy. No one is like throwing money at you to make, you know, any movie. So, but it was made easier by the fact that we had kind of, you know, it felt like a made sense for people as a movie to make after The Invitation. And also then, of course, once Nicole Kidman wanted to do it, that was the catalyst that kind of pushed it over the edge.
I was just going to say, yeah, it definitely was more like there was a more receptive audience. It was easier to get in rooms for, you know, for financing for this movie, you know, but again, like it's never easy. But The Invitation kind of served as like proof of concept in some ways.
So there's no talking about this movie without talking about Nicole Kidman, obviously. And the way it starts, you start with her stumbling out of this car, walking over to a crime scene. She is the first thing you notice, specifically the fact that she looks like she's been smoking crack for about 15 years. She has the least flattering haircut possible. She's obviously looks prematurely aged. Nicole Kidman, incredibly beautiful woman. This is a very deliberate choice. Even her voice sounds different. At what point after you cast her, like, what's the conversation around that? Because this didn't happen by accident, right? And when you cast Nicole Kidman, it's not like, you know, when you cast, you might think, well, we're getting beautiful, you know, elegant Nicole Kidman. Like, where did that process, how did that all work out?
I think a lot of it started with the conversation between her and Karin. You know, once you know, Nicole read the script and loved it and was ready to do it, it was a conversation, but it was, you know, it was a conversation between Karin and Nicole about how the character was going to need to look and need to be, and Nicole was, you know, saw it the exact same way. There wasn't a lot of daylight between their two conceptions of the character's look. So, and she, you know, And so, you know, Nicole was really game to kind of explore this really battered person and to kind of become that. And she really did. She really inhabits that character.
And I think she, in the conversations that she had with Karin and then with us as we kind of went along in the process, that I think what she saw. I mean, there's the obvious thing, which is to take a part like this and to want to portray this character. It obviously shows a lack of vanity, that she's not approaching it with vanity at all, and she's not approaching it. She wants to look at, she'd say often, like, I don't want people to see me when they look at this character, which is, you know, maybe sounds obvious, but it's not the approach. Even in very real, very dark, very gritty material, that's not always true when you look at an actor in a film. And so she, I think part of the intrigue for her and what made it necessary, because I mean, I think we always look at things as like, what, why is it absolutely necessary for her to be and to appear and to come across the way she does? And because very early we started talking about how this is a character who is really rotting from the inside, and who has the and who has lived in an environment that is very punishing, like the sort of brutal sunlight of the desert and of Los Angeles, and that has taken a toll, and that she's not a character that takes care of herself. And the part of the reason that she doesn't take care of herself is because she's dealing with so much self-loathing and so much anger. And she's really, we always talked about the character in terms of someone who's really being destroyed from inside and consumed by herself. And that's why that look is, that's why she looks that way. And there was also something related, you know, like Nicole found this way of walking in the movie that is very specific and very just Aaron Bell. And she we talked about it later, and this was just felt right to her, but she talked a lot about coyotes as an animal that, I mean, it's like an animal that is so meaningful in LA, and especially in the part of LA we live in, but also like that she also, it's almost a cowboy kind of gait. And that also plays into some interesting stuff with the kind of mythology around the movie and about this character, so.
Yeah, I was watching it and my wife walks by, has not seen the movie, does not know any context of this. And she's like, is that Nicole Kidman? She looks terrifying. And it's like pretty much, I think it, she looks like in the zombie movies, like when somebody's been bitten, but they haven't turned yet. That's kind of like.
Yeah, where it's like, it's so funny. It's such a, you know, it's a brave thing to commit to that. And she really did. And it's just, it's funny, like, you want to be supportive and make the person feel great. And then the first like 3 days on set, like everybody paired with her in a scene, like they're one of their first lines is like, you look awful. So the first 3 days of the movie, we have characters just telling her how awful she looks.
Yeah, I have that. I'll just quickly get there. So basically in the plot, we meet Nicole Kidman. She's playing LAPD detective Aaron Bell. She arrives on the scene of what seems like a John Doe murder, tells the responding officers she knows the identity of the murderer. At the police station, she gets this $100 bill stained from a dye pack in an unmarked envelope. She goes to a contact at the FBI, finds out that the bill is from a bank robbery committed by this California gang that she was undercover in years ago with this other agent named Chris. They were undercover officers in this gang. And she thinks that the gang's leader, Silas, is active again. We see this great scene where Nicole and Sebastian Stan, who I will henceforth refer to as the Winter Soldier probably, are preparing for their stint as undercover cops. And they're making sure they have their backstory straight. It's a lot of really great specific writing. She starts in the present, she investigates the remaining members of the gang. And so she goes to see this guy, Toby. He was in prison, now he's out. He is gravely ill, he's living with his mother. And there's this hilarious moment where he looks terrible, but like he's dying. There's a reason he looks terrible, right? And he sees her and he goes, man, you look old.
Right.
So it's like, even to that guy, you know, she doesn't look great.
Yeah, the society we live in, fortunately, you know, it's more like, it's just like, even a dying guy is still sexist and judging, you know.
I think this scene is the first scene that really made me kind of sit up and take notice of this movie as being very different from other movies. And like, I think your guys' voice in a weird way, like The Invitation is kind of a weird movie. This is kind of a weird, there's things that I just get. The specificity of it, right? So it's like, he's there, he's dying. His mom is going to the store and he says, you know, get me some cookies. I don't care about the sugar, we're past that. Then he asks Nicole Kidman to turn around this owl sculpture that's, you know, he thinks is staring at him. And then she gives him the saddest hand job in film history in exchange for information about this other guy, Arturo, another member of the gang. A very uncomfortable scene to watch. Was it uncomfortable to film, or was it one of those things where everybody's joking around?
It was very, I think it was, I wouldn't say it was uncomfortable to film, but it was a lot of, there was a lot of care taken to be, that was a scene where nobody was on set that didn't have to be there. And it was treated with, you know, no one was watching monitors that didn't have to be, absolutely have to be watching monitors. It was very well controlled because, I mean, I think, you know, as, you know, not only the writers, but the producers of the movie, you know, it's very like top priority for all of us is to make sure actors feel comfortable to do the work that they have to do. And that's not just in scenes that are sort of, you know, intense and provocative on that. And that way, it's true of every scene that, you know, you're just trying to figure out how you create the right bubble around the people so that they can just do the work that they have to do. And it's so much of it too, like, not just that scene, but, you know, every scene that the movie is structured, as you kind of said, when you were going through it, it's structured as this journey through a lot of different people that you're meeting both in the past and the present. And something we figured out quickly when we were shooting it, we were so grateful to for how great our actors were, because, you know, it's something, and Sebastian talked about a few times, like it's something when you show up on the set and you're gonna play opposite Nicole Kidman, who's one of the greatest actors living ever, you know, like that there is a certain, you know, as an actor, you want to deliver. And there's also a sense of the very first scene she shot in the movie was a scene between her and her former kind of FBI mentor played by Toby Huss. And we were so grateful to have Toby in that first scene because he is such a tremendous actor and so strong that immediately Nicole was like, he's fantastic. Like, here's a guy that's meeting me on my level. And she, over and over again, as we worked through the scenes, that's how she felt about the actors that were across from her. And, you know, that's obviously so meaningful.
Yeah. And I appreciate what you're saying about the specificity. I take it as a big compliment. And, you know, it's, as you know, those are the things that get shaved off as you go through the development process sometimes. And you know, part of the bubble we had is this kind of creatively in sync little bubble where we got to go for it with that specificity. Because to me and Phil and Arne, I think that's what kind of makes it real and human, is these weird little peccadillos people have, these weird obsessions that just can't help but out themselves. But that's the first thing that gets kind of like shaved down, because someone will be like, that's weird. People won't get, that's weird.
In a way, but
no, yeah, no. That's it. I was just gonna add, like, I think that's really felt in the next big scene, which is this flashback scene where we see Silas pressure Arturo into putting a gun to his head. And it's the Russian roulette gag we've obviously seen in a million movies. But what makes it unique is that they're just like hanging out, and it's very clear that Silas is just bored and just tells Arturo, take this gun, put it to your head. There's definitely bullets in it. You might die, but you have to do it just because I told you to. And that's, again, it's like, I don't even know how to explain it. That's like, it's like the same thing with the invitation, right? It's just this feeling of just like, you're sort of just thrown off as an audience, because usually we're used to things where it's very hard and fast, right? So it would be like, hey, you have to put this gun in your head. And he would verbally make a threat or something and say like, otherwise I will do blah, blah, blah. He doesn't do that. And then Arturo still does it and is clearly like psychologically destroyed by doing it. And then afterwards, Silas has some line where he's like, this is a loaded gun, you maniac. Like, we should go get lottery tickets. And that scene is so great. And so, yeah, it's just, it's hard for me to explain it to the audience. Like, if you haven't seen the movie, how different that is from just the average cop movie.
Well, in a way, thank you. And in a way, I think, you know, for us, kind of going off what Matt was saying, what we sort of realized about ourselves over the years of, you know, making independent movies like Destroyer and the Invitation, but then a lot of studio movies as well, is, you know, what the opportunity is when we're working for ourselves and working for Karin, you know, that like, what we truly, and it's just what we truly believe is interesting, and finding those little corners in the characters and the little corners in the scenes and narrative, you know, that's what to us makes it special or makes it something we have to do versus there's plenty of cop movies, there's plenty of horror movies, there's plenty of thrillers, but like to make one that is really meaningful to all of us, it's all about those details and the weirdness, frankly. And as Matt said, like, you know, it's like, I don't know if we would have got to, you know, it was so important for us to make both The Invitation and Destroyer and the movies that we have kind of coming up, in that realizing that for us, it was important to not have those details shaved off and not have the imperative just be the absolute kind of cold, hard minimum of story and character, which is sort of like the big commercial imperative in some ways, or it's sort of like in a way how you're taught to write, you know, big studio screenplays. And there's obviously so many different ways to do that. And we found ways that we love to do that. But I think, you know, I'm glad that you pointed out that like, it is those weird details. And, you know, to kind of to the topic of the podcast, like, I think we're really comfortable with the fact that like our goal, we always say like before we start making these movies, is we want to make a movie that could theoretically be someone's favorite movie in the world. Mm-hmm. And the only way to do that is to make it as individual and weird and specific as possible. And that also means there's other people who are not going to get it or yeah. who are not going to be into it. And that's fine. But we're trying to grab the most passionate people versus like necessarily the broadest kind of dispassionate group of people. And so that's kind of, you know, that's kind of where, how we operate in a way.
Yeah. I'm going to zip ahead just to keep us on time. So basically what happens is Erin gets Arturo's name from the last guy she spoke to, goes to see, and then he gets her Dennis DeFranco, who is this lawyer that was laundering money for them. Perfectly cast Bradley Whitford. This whole scene is great. He's yelling at his son as he's doing batting practice in his mansion in Palos Verdes. If The Sopranos was still around, I think you guys would have, like, after this movie, gone to write for The Sopranos, because I don't know if you've listened to the Talking Sopranos podcast, but they talk a lot about how Sopranos always had, it was never just like, you know, Bobby's at the store. It was always like so hyper specific. And that's the same thing in this scene. All these like little funny, weird, sad, interesting details. Such a sense of like, there's a whole world here that we're just kind of scratching the surface of. At the end of it, Erin deduces that Silas is active again because the money from the heist is almost gone. DeFranco gives Erin the location of the next money drop, which is performed by Silas's girlfriend, Petra, who's developed a severe drug addiction. Erin tracks Petra and eventually intervenes in a bank robbery committed by Silas's new gang. So this whole bit, the bank robbery thing, is so incredibly choreographed by Karin. There's a shot at the beginning of it. So we're sort of with Nicole Kidman. She's sort of like, you know, she's following Petra around. You kind of know, all right, something's going to happen, but I just love the way it's done. It's almost thrown away, right? Like she sees this van, it kind of pulls up slowly. Like, okay, something weird's going on. People are walking around with bags. And then the door opens and the guys come out with masks and machine guns. And it's not like, I think the bad way of doing it would have been the door opens, you know, extreme close up, super cool. They jump out. It's not that. We're seeing it from Nicole Kidman's POV. And so casually, it feels like a documentary. You're like, oh shit. Like you feel like it's real. And it's totally the heat thing. Obviously, like that's, you can't escape that, right? The big machine gun shootout bank robbery. But the way that it's done, the way that it's shot, the buildup to it, it is still doing its own thing. I think it's a rare example. And I made a movie called American Heist, which I think just honestly did not do this as successfully, but you know, everybody tries to rip off that sequence from Heat. And I think that if you can do it in a way where you're still doing your own thing successfully, but it's like it's kind of honoring that's like the ideal world. And I think this does that. When you guys first see the movie, so you know, you've made the movie, you go see it at the big screening at the movie theater, is that the moment where you kind of look at each other and you're like, shit, can you believe we actually got to make this movie?
I mean, I think, you know, in the movies we've done with Karin, it's kind of, for me at least, it's kind of the whole movie, because, you know, we have this great thing going where, you know, Phil and I write the script and Karin makes it as we imagined, but better. You know what I mean? It's such a gratifying creative process where you don't feel anything was left on the table, and you don't, and Karin brings such inspiration and care and specificity to it. It's kind of a dream to have her direct our scripts and to work so closely with her. So, you know, for me, it's the whole movie. That particular sequence, what I love about The Heat, and we definitely talked about that sequence, it's obviously like the sound. It's a sound you know, it's not the stock gunshots that you hear. It feels very real and immediate. And that was, I think, one of that feel was kind of one of the driving forces in terms of our conception of it, was for it to feel real and that sense of immediacy as opposed to kind of action-y.
Yeah, that was definitely the way we always talked about it. That sequence was so important to us. And in fact, it was one of the very first things that we wrote, was that entire sequence from the bank robbery through the ice cream shop with Petra. And because it is, like, in a way, it's such a big part of the core of the movie. And we always talked about it, like, it can't be an action movie. You know, it has to be it's a war movie, if anything. And that's how the approach to that bit of action was. And it is kind of interesting when you, it is, because it's a tonal thing, because it's not an action movie, you know. And it definitely, you know, it's true that Heat is just on the mountaintop in terms of shootouts. And I think, you know, we tried to find our way in that was very specific to who she was. And it is interesting, like, the reality of it, you know, when you have, you know, we're using quarter load blanks in a confined space, and it's so loud. And it's kind of incredible to watch the cast and the extras. The first time they go in and the guns start going off, it really is like, it's stunning. And you realize that's as quarter as loud as it is when someone's actually shooting a gun. And so the physical body reactions really are very real when you're in a space like that. And so, you know, that was really interesting. And the other thing about that sequence I just want to mention is, like, we, at one point we're speaking with, we had some really great advisors who trained Nicole in firearms and who, you know, also are kind of LAPD advisors. And it was funny, at one point we were rehearsing and someone asked, well, would this, you know, would they really do this, or would this really happen? We want to be as real as we can. And they said, this is a former, you know, SWAT guy, said, like, literally anything you can imagine has happened.
Right.
It's complete chaos when this kind of stuff goes down. And so there's nothing that you could do except for everyone being completely competent that would be unrealistic. So it's kind of really interesting.
Yeah, that sequence is incredible. We're going to quickly break for our sponsor. When we come back, we're going to talk about the end of the movie. Really critical stuff there. We'll be right back.
Movies I Love That No One Talks About is brought to you by Virtual Pitch Fest. Virtual Pitch Fest is a trusted industry source that specializes in connecting screenwriters with production companies and representatives. With Virtual Pitch Fest, writers can search through an online database, almost like a dating site, to see what 500 plus participating companies are looking for. They can then send short written pitches on their scripts to chosen companies with the assurance of a guaranteed response back. That's right, guaranteed. You get an answer, you get a fair shot. That's a really critical difference with this service compared to some of the other online pitch services for writers. To date, site connections have led to 150 plus success stories, including produced films. There's actually a Bruce Willis, Megan Fox movie that was recently produced directly because of Virtual Pitch Fest. Just a writer who, you know, was relatively unknown, went on there, did a pitch. The pitch was picked up by a producer, and then that ended up becoming this movie. There's also been dozens of other script deals, many writers landing representation. If this sounds like something that could be useful to you, check out Virtual Pitch Fest at virtualpitchfest.com.
Okay, we're back. So Aaron and Petra brutally injure each other in this fight that kind of comes after the bank robbery sequence. Aaron abducts Petra. Flashbacks reveal that Aaron and Chris developed a romantic relationship while undercover, with Aaron eventually becoming pregnant, later having their daughter, who is Shelby. At Aaron's behest, they decided to become legitimate participants in a bank robbery, and they were going to take their shares of the heist and basically just kind of pretend, feign ignorance, and eventually quit the police force and have this money. But that robbery was botched when a dye pack exploded in one of the bags, and Silas killed the bank teller who placed it, and then also Chris when he tried to intervene. After that robbery, Aaron crashes the van in a dumpster, seriously injures Toby, and hides her share of the heist, and she just kind of goes back to being a police officer and like just doesn't say anything about it. In the present, Aaron talks with her daughter, Shelby, who is this, you know, there's this whole kind of subplot with her being this troubled teenager. The scene with them is so gut-wrenching. That could be like its own short film. Silas sends a text message to Petra's phone, which Aaron has. So she meets him and basically gets the drop on him, shoots him, avenges Chris. I was curious, was there ever more of Silas? Was there more of him at a script stage? Was there more of him in a different cut stage? Because it felt like you guys, that, because that Russian roulette scene, he's almost becomes like a Mephisto, like a mystical kind of villain. And I was just curious if there was ever more of him at some point.
I think there was actually less of him at one point. The Russian roulette scene was one of the final scenes we wrote for the movie, because we did want to get a better sense of him as a villain and the kind of the mental hold he has on people, as opposed to, you know, threatening them all the time. And I think, you know, it was always kind of a question of how little we could tell, because, you know, again, we're working with memory and you know, Aaron's point of view. And so these are the critical moments she remembers. So rather than filling in the entire backstory, it was, you know, what are the potent moments that are going to drive her? What are the things that she keeps going over in her head? You know, what are the things that she can't let go of? And so that was kind of the approach to Silas in flashback, which he's, you know, I guess 85%, 90% in flashback.
It's interesting because that character, you know, there's a couple ways to go with it. And it's funny because the more obvious way is to, you know, invest a tremendous amount of time in that character and make him the most devastatingly horrible, you know, Kaiser Soze like figure in the world. And then there's other version, which is to kind of really, which is what we did, which is to try to focus just on what he meant to Aaron and just really seeing him through her eyes. Because really, the secret is that he's a villain, but he's not the villain. She's the villain to herself. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's sort of interesting. One of our friends who saw an early cut of the movie, who's a filmmaker, said, and a couple of people have said this since, which I think was so interesting, was to say that, you know, this movie obviously in a way is very much a film noir, and that Aaron is both the detective and the femme fatale and the criminal, like all in once. And so so with Silas, I think we were trying to find just those moments that were most important and go from there.
I was curious, he correct me if I track this all right. There's a thing where he basically says, like, I see you, like, I know who you are. And it's sort of implied that maybe he's figured out that she's an undercover cop. And then, like, at the end, it's implied that he sent her the $100 bill, right? So why did he do that? And I wasn't, like, I actually like that I don't 100% know the answer. And now I've seen the movie a couple of times, but I was just interested in that whole ambiguous thing about him.
I think that part of it was about that it's part of it's about the power that you have over someone who has a secret. Mm. And the idea of what's really important to him is to control people and to control her specifically. That's like his thing. And so the kind of arrogance and hubris, it's not a smart tactical idea, you know, to like let her know where he is in a way, but that the idea that, you know, he still controls her, and the reason she's controllable is because of secret, or at least he thinks she's controllable, and that, so it's sort of that idea that moral corruption. I think when you say the part about him seeing her, I think he may have an inkling, but I think he's really talking about, I see that you're like me, and that there's emptiness inside, and you're just waiting for someone to give you permission to do what you want. And you're not really a good person. This is all the stuff he's saying. Right. And he's challenging the idea of being a good person, and why would you, in a way? Right. So he's sort of like, you know, seeing a darkness in her, basically.
Yeah. Did you have the, so the full circle of this, and it feels very noir, is that the dead guy from the beginning of the movie, the John Doe, is Silas. And that's the circle we kind of make when we get to the end. Was that something you guys had just from conception? Because it feels so intrinsic to the piece. Is it something that was there before you even write the script?
It was. It was, you know, the germ of this, the movie was, what if we told a cop story like this, where the protagonist is essentially chasing his or herself? And, you know, And we had this structure where you're going to see this scene, but it actually means this. You think the person is doing this, but they're actually doing this because of what you will understand at the end of the movie. So it is a big kind of twist at the end. And so we knew that, but I think, you know, in almost cliche terms, we didn't really understand the plot until we got to the character of Aaron Bell. Once we knew it was going to be this woman, and what she was going to be like, then the reason for all these scenes, which we were having, like the structure was just kind of a big morass for a while, even though we knew what it wanted to be. Like, we couldn't really, it became a much easier task once we knew exactly who this story was going to be about, and the reason why it had to be told this way.
So then at the very, very end, she gives evidence of her guilt to her partner, Antonio, who's been calling her the whole movie. And then she just kind of sits in the car and bleeds to death. I wanted to ask you guys, so I'm represented CA. I don't remember if you guys are too, but basically something I've been talking to my agent about is this idea that because of the pandemic, people want lighthearted stuff, and the darker stuff is now more difficult to sell, and so on and so forth. And I was thinking about that as I watched the end of your movie, where she dies, you know, in her car by herself. Specifically, you even twist the knife further that it seems like her last memory is this very romantic conversation that she has with Sebastian Stan, where it is extremely clear that it's 1,000% her fault that he's dead. He didn't want to do it at all. She totally pressured him into it. They were legitimately in love with each other. They have this very sweet moment that in the context of this world is sweet, where she tells him like, nice ass, and he says, hey, it's all yours. And it actually plays like very legitimately romantic. It's so bleak. I loved it because I'm a kind of person. This is the kind of ending that I love in a movie. But I was just interested in like your thoughts on this whole theory that has arisen out of the pandemic, that people want this lighthearted stuff.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think there's always, I mean, to me, like maybe the obvious thing is like, there's always room for everything. I think like, if you look around, I think it's funny. The thing that we just have done is very lighthearted, called the Mysterious Benedict Society, which couldn't be more different than
Disney Plus, right?
Yes, on Disney Plus.
Yes.
And that definitely, I think we started it so long ago. I mean, very, very far before the pandemic. So it just was naturally what it was. But I do think that it has been a part of its reception that it is something that is humane and is positive and funny. But I don't know, I believe, like, to me, it's interesting because it's like everyone kind of brings a different thing to it. Like I when I go to a movie, like I'm really, the thing that I most prize is I'm looking to, if I can cry, that's what I'm looking for. If I can feel that, like, just attached to like the finality of death and attached to like the value of life and all those things that these movies strangely are the best vehicle to deliver for me personally. That's what we're looking for. So like, in a way, the end of the movie to me is, I hope that for people it feels cathartic, that it feels like she's reached the end of this journey, but she has succeeded in a very small way. And well, she succeeded in one, in small to massive ways, from giving her daughter the tools to move on without her by making it so that her last memory of her mother is not what it has been, but with some hope, and also actually coming to terms with herself and taking responsibility, that that's like something very spiritually meaningful for her. So to me, like, that is, there is, I wouldn't call it uplifting, but I would say there's something
redemptive.
That's the idea, that she just has to take responsibility in the end, and this is how she had to do it ultimately.
Just a couple things. You guys produced a Friedkin documentary, right?
Yes. Alexander is brilliant.
Friedkin felt like a huge influence here.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think for all of us, and it was interesting, like, we did, Beyond Fest did a double feature screening that was fantastic of Destroyer and To Live and Die in LA.
Oh.
And Karin did a Q&A with Friedkin afterwards, and it was fascinating and kind of amazing. It was like really, truly a perfect pairing. And yeah. The sense of, I mean, the sense of that light in LA, and the cops in LA is such a thing that's deeply, and you talk about heat, you talk about, you know, all of the, there's so many, such a great tradition that, like, yeah. But that's certainly.
And the approach to character, just the flawed individual who doesn't necessarily see the error of their ways in the traditional way, you know? And like Phil said, like the light in LA, and just the faithfulness to LA, that was a big thing. I heard Michael Mann talk about Heat, and he was very, and Collateral, and, you know, just the dedication to, you know, getting it right about LA.
Funny, Karin and I had dinner last night with our location manager, Robert, who is like the best in the business. And that specificity of LA was such a part of this process from beginning to end.
Yeah. Final question, and I asked this also, I had on the guy who wrote Triple Nine. We talked about this.
Yeah.
The stuff that's happened in our country, which, you know, was happening anyway, which has been brought to light more with the police, does that mean that we don't get to make these movies anymore? Because that's a real, I mean, I basically have a project like this that I've been trying to get going, and I've been having these conversations with people about essentially, like, let's just put those kind of movies away for a couple of years. I don't know. I understand that it is fraught for some people, but I think it would be sad if we lost the corrupt cop movie, because I think there's so many storytelling opportunities it affords us outside of any sort of political, you know, import to it.
Yeah, I tend to think, yeah, for me, it's just what the movie is, and what it's not just trying to say, but what it feels like. And I think if you're interrogating, I think that, like, you have a, I think if you're making a cop movie, you have a duty to interrogate it, but yeah. You also have a duty to make the movie if that movie is, needs to be made. And I think it's just interesting. I think the like, for me, I think there is so much interesting to explore with these types of characters. And again, it's like, I don't know that we will necessarily do another cop movie, but I love cop movies. I'm just interested in them. And I think we're definitely moving to a time where we're interrogating it more, and really interrogating some of the things that we just had gotten used to seeing on TV and not questioning. And I mean, and I think that's a very good thing.
Yeah, I think it's the same way that, you know, in some ways that they were having trouble with what to do with Superman for a while, because he's so universally good in so many of the iterations. And so what do you do with that? And I think it's the same way, whether you, if you have the policemen, just all these policemen just getting cats out of trees, you know, for the whole thing, or the exact opposite, it's going to feel flat. And so, like, I think there are certain movies where, as long as you are, it just, I think it depends on the character, you know, it depends on, you know, how real this person feels and how real the situation feels.
And also that it plays again, I mean, you know, and we don't really have this in our film, but like that, you know, it is a very common, you know, I think that there's certain things that you see in different light as a writer that used to be a very common too, you know, you know, I think that the lens on the interrogation scene is necessarily much more refined, or should be, or, you know, on the idea of police brutality, casual police brutality. What does that mean to see that over and over on television or in movies? And I think that's the sort of thing that, again, it's good to interrogate as part of a story.
All right, cool, guys. Well, I don't want to take any more of your time. That is our show for this week. If you want to keep up with the show, join our Facebook group, Movies I Love That No One Talks About, or follow me on Instagram at the same. And if you dig the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. It's a big help to the show. I want to thank my guests, Phil Hay and Matt Manfredi. Until next time, bye-bye.